of truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. There are currently 2,150 architects and engineers who have signed the petition demanding a new investigation into the events of 9/11 on the website ae911truth.org. There are also 18,494 regular folks who have signed the petition. If you'd like a new and independent investigation of the events of 9/11, then please do your part and go to the website ae911truth.org and add your name to the growing list. Time's not on our side, so the sooner we all come together and demand this new investigation, the better for all of us. You can also find other ways to help out on that website. And if you're new to the 9/11 truth movement, they have lots of scientific evidence that I would encourage you to go there and check it out about how the Twin Towers and Building 7, World Trade Center Building 7, fell on 9/11. It's not what you've been told by the official government story. And it's backed up by the actual scientific evidence. Today on the show, I'm going to tell you about a new New York City ballot initiative. Then you'll hear a speech from the September 2013 9/11 conference in Washington, D.C. about the FBI entrapment of Muslims. And then at the end, I'll share with you about our movie coming up on February 24th. So let's begin with the new New York ballot initiative. The website is highrisesafetynyc.org. Again, that's highrisesafetynyc.org, and you can learn more about this. I'm just going to give you the overview of what they say on their website. The High Rise Safety Initiative is a ballot initiative that will require the New York City Department of Buildings to investigate the causes of all high-rise building collapses in New York City. The High Rise Safety Initiative will appear on the November 4, 2014 ballot after the requisite number of signatures has been gathered and the petition has been found to meet all the requirements of federal, state, and local law. Under the provisions of the High-Rise Safety Initiative, the Department of Buildings will have the responsibility to investigate all high-rise building collapses that occur in the future and all high-rise building collapses that occurred on or after September 11, 2001. The provisions of the High-Rise Safety Initiative exclude the collapse of World Trade Center 1 and 2, but apply to any high-rise collapse that occurs in the future, as well as the collapse of World Trade Center 7 on September 11, 2001. In New York State, all local ballot initiatives requiring the expenditure of public funds must include a new source of revenue. The High-Rise Safety Initiative proposes a 0.9% surcharge on construction permits issued by the Department of Buildings, estimated to raise $1 million per year. The 0.9% surcharge will be lifted if the high-rise safety fund exceeds $3 million and reinstated if the high-rise safety fund falls below $1 million. The purpose of this initiative is to make high-rises safer by compelling a new investigation into the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 and ensuring timely and comprehensive investigations when high-rise collapses occur in the future. On September 11, 2001, the world witnessed the three largest structural failures in history: the collapse of World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 2 in the morning, and later that day, the collapse of World Trade Center 7, a 47-story high-rise that was located on the north side of the World Trade Center complex. In the weeks and months after 9/11, the city of New York oversaw a massive cleanup effort that resulted in the destruction of most of the steel debris from Ground Zero, despite urgent requests from the public for the steel to be preserved. The city's handling of the forensic evidence and the federal government's meager efforts to investigate the disaster were roundly criticized by the 9/11 families and the many voices in the engineering community. New York municipal home rule laws allow for voters in New York State to amend their city's charters through a ballot initiative process. In order for the proposed charter amendment to appear on the November 4, 2014 ballot, the High-Rise Safety Initiative must file a petition with the City of New York containing at least 30,000 signatures from registered New York City voters by July 3, 2014. If the City Council does not adopt the proposed charter amendment or vote to put it on the November 2014 ballot after 2 months, the High-Rise Safety Initiative can file a second petition containing at least 15,000 signatures by September 5th and thereby ensure that the proposed charter amendment appears on the November 2014 ballot. So this group is up and running. They're going to be hiring a highly qualified company to get the required signatures, et cetera, and they could use your help. So if you want to check them out, please go to the website highrisesafetynyc.org. And now here's Frank Tolupko of our local 9/11 Truth Group introducing Isa Hodge at the Washington, D.C. 9/11 conference in September 2013. Frank was a key player in putting on the D.C. conference. And here he is.
Okay, the final speaker in this particular section is going to be Isa Hodge. Isa is the operations chief of AMPAC, the previously mentioned American Muslim Political Action Committee. Isa is an American-born Christian converted to Islam when he was 19 years of age. For the last 20 years, he has spent time working through the ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America, with its dawah, which means sharing knowledge, and interfaith youth boards in the Kansas City area. He has given lectures at various colleges on the truth about Islam in contrast to the media's version. He does a radio show on AMPAC Radio called Real Political Talk and has written a number of articles on various subjects about current political events. In my studies or research, I've seen that there are approximately 50 cases that have been brought by the FBI against Muslims, saying they were caught in the act of preparing for another terrorist attack or event or whatever. But in virtually every one of those cases in the court records, it indicates that the FBI itself was involved in either providing materiel or providing agents provocateurs, etc. So this was really an attack against the Muslim community to try to demonize them, as we just learned in this particular presentation. So without further ado, I would like to bring up Isa Hodge, who can talk about the entrapment of young Muslim men.
This speech was edited some to fit into the half-hour show. To see and hear the full speech, the website is dc911conference.org.
So actually, as I said in the beginning, I wanted to go on emotion. I wanted you guys to have an opportunity to look through the eyes of a Muslim. So I took one person that was falsely accused, and that his actual last statement after being sentenced was actually publicly put out there. And I thought it was interesting. Now, mind you, this guy's name is Tariq Mahena, all right? And he was actually charged with plotting terrorist threats or activities, all because he spoke out against the United States. Now, of course, he never funded in any terror attacks or anything like that. He never actually participated in any killing of any citizens. He never participated in actually any planning of killing any citizens. The prosecution actually said it throughout the trial. But because his rhetoric within his own personal laptop and his own personal life was that of anti-war, that he did not believe the Mujahideen were terrorists. He believed them to be freedom fighters. Our own president in 1986, Ronald Reagan, said that they were the moral example of the founding fathers. And he was talking about the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Okay? So he put the Mujahideen, that's now the Taliban, that we now have spent trillions of dollars to kill and hunt, who we are now helping to put into power in order for us to be able to back out so we can move into Syria, which is the back door to... Oh, there I go. Sorry. Talking about things that's beyond my scope. Sorry. But we all know where that's headed. Of course, we got Iran right after that because that's the back door. Anyways. So actually what I would like to do is I'd like to read the statement that Tariq had actually was able to speak in the court and actually got one paper to print it. And this was not easy to find, actually. And if you probably try to Google it now, you might not find it. He begins, "In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful." He says, "Exactly 4 years ago this month, I was finishing my work shift at a local hospital. As I was walking to my car, I was approached by two federal agents. They said I had a choice to make. I could do things the easy way, or I could do them the hard way. The easy way, as they explained, was that I had become an informant for the government. And if I did so, I would never see the inside of a courtroom or a prison cell. As for the hard way, this is it. Here I am, having spent the majority of 4 years since then in a solitary cell the size of a small closet, in which I am locked down for 23 hours each day. The FBI and these prosecutors worked very hard, and the government spent millions of tax dollars to put me in that cell, keeping me there, putting me on trial, and finally, to have me stand here before you today to be sentenced to even more time in a cell. In the weeks leading up to this moment, many people have offered suggestions as to what I should say to you. Some said I should plead for mercy in the hopes of a light sentence, and while others suggest I would be hit hard either way. But what I want to do is just talk about myself for a few minutes. When I refused to become an informant, the government responded by charging me with the crime of supporting Mujahideen fighting and the occupation of Muslim countries around the world, or as they like to call them, the terrorists. I wasn't born in a Muslim country, though. I was born and raised right here in America. And this is something which angers many people. How is it that I can be an American and believe the things I believe, take the positions I take, everything a man is exposed to in this environment becomes an ingredient that shapes his outlook, and I am no different. So in more ways than one, it's because of America that I am who I am. When I was 6, I began putting together a massive collection of comic books. Batman implanted a concept in my mind, introduced me to a paradigm as to how the world is set up, that there are oppressors, there are the oppressed, and there are those who set up to defend the oppressed. This resonated with me so much that throughout the rest of my childhood, I gravitated to any book that reflected this paradigm. Uncle Tom's Cabin, the autobiography of Malcolm X. I even saw an ethical dimension in The Catcher in the Rye. By the time I began high school and took a real history class, I was learning just how real that paradigm is in the real world. I learned about the Native Americans and what befell them at the hands of European settlers, my ancestors, most of our ancestors in here. I learned about how the descendants of those European settlers were in turn oppressed under the tyranny of King George III. I read about Paul Revere, Tom Paine, and how Americans began an armed insurgency against British forces, an insurgency we now celebrate as the American Revolution War. As a child, I even went on school field trips at the sites of battlefields, some just blocks from the courthouse. I learned about Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner, John Brown, and the fight against slavery in this country. I learned about Emma Goldman, Eugene Debs, and the struggles of the labor unions, working class and poor. I learned about Anne Frank, the Nazis, and how the persecuted minorities and imprisoned dissidents. I learned about Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and the Civil Rights Movement. I learned about Ho Chi Minh and how the Vietnamese fought for decades to liberate themselves from one invader after another. I learned about Nelson Mandela and the fight against apartheid in South Africa. Everything I learned in those years confirmed what I was beginning to learn when I was 6, that throughout history there has been a constant struggle between the oppressed and the oppressors. With each struggle I learned about, I found myself consistently siding with the oppressed and consistently respecting those who stepped up to defend them, regardless of nationality or religion. And I never threw my class notes away. As I stand here speaking, they are in a neat pile in my bedroom closet at home. From all the historical figures I learned about, one stood out above the rest. I was impressed by many things about Malcolm X, but above all, I was fascinated by the idea of transformation, his transformation. I don't know if you've seen the movie Malcolm X by Spike Lee. It is over 3.5 hours long, and the Malcolm X at the beginning is different from the Malcolm X at the end. He starts off as an illiterate criminal, but ends up a husband, a father, a protected, and eloquent leader of his people. A disciplined Muslim performing Hajj in Mecca, and finally a martyr. Malcolm's life taught me that Islam is not something inherited. It is not a culture of ethnicity. It is a way of life, a state of mind. Anyone can choose, no matter where they come from or how they were raised. This led me to look deeper into Islam, and I was hooked. I was just a teenager, but Islam answered the question that the greatest scientific minds were clueless about. The questions that drive the rich and famous to depression and suicide from being unable to answer. What is the purpose of life? Why do we exist in this universe? But it also answered the question of how we're supposed to exist. And since there's no hierarchy or priesthood, I could directly and immediately begin digging into the text of the Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, to begin the journey of understanding what was this all about. And the more I learned, the more I valued Islam like a piece of gold. This was when I was a teen, but even today, despite the pressures of the last few years, I stand here before you and everyone else in this courtroom as a very proud Muslim. With that, my attention turned to what was happening to other Muslims in different parts of the world. And everywhere I looked, I saw powers that be trying to destroy what I loved. I learned what the Soviets had done to the Muslims of Afghanistan. I learned what the Serbs had done to the Muslims of Bosnia. And I learned what the Russians were doing to Muslims in Chechnya. I learned what Israel had done to Lebanon and what it continues to do to Palestine with the full backing of the United States. And I learned what America itself was doing to Muslims. I learned about the Gulf War and the depleted uranium bombs that killed thousands and caused cancer rates to skyrocket across Iraq. I learned about the American-led sanctions that prevented food, medicine, and medical equipment from entering Iraq, and how, according to the United Nations, over 500,000 children perished as a result. I remember a clip from 60 Minutes interviewing of Madeleine Albright, where she expressed her view that these dead children were worth it. I watched on September 11th as a group of people, according to the government, were driven to the belief of hijacking airplanes and flying them into buildings from their outrage at the deaths of these children. I watched as America then attacked and invaded Iraq directly. I saw the effects of shock and awe in the opening days of the invasion. The children in hospitals, hospital wards with shrapnel from American missiles sticking out of their foreheads. Of course, none of this was shown on CNN. I learned about the town of Haditha, where 24 Muslims, including a 76-year-old man in a wheelchair, women, and even toddlers were shot up, blown in their bedclothes, and then as they slept by U.S. Marines. I learned about Abir al-Janabi, a 14-year-old Iraqi girl gang raped by five American soldiers who then shot her and her family in the head, then set fire to their corpses. I just want to point out, as you can see, Muslim women don't even show their hair to unrelated men. So try to imagine this young girl from a conservative village with her dress torn off as she is being sexually assaulted by not one, not two, not three, but five soldiers. Even today, as I sit in my jail cell, I read about the drone strikes, which continue to kill Muslims daily in places like Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. Just last month, we all heard about the 17 Afghan Muslims, mostly mothers and their children, shot to death by an American soldier who was set fire to their corpses afterwards. These are just stories that make it to the headlines, but one of the few concepts, first concepts, I learned in Islam is that of loyalty and brotherhood, that each Muslim woman in the world is my sister, each man is my brother, and together we are a large body who must protect one another. In other words, I couldn't witness these things being done by brothers and sisters, including by America, and remain neutral and remain silent. My sympathy for the oppressed continued, but was now more personal as my respect for those defending them. I mentioned Paul Revere when he jumped on a horse and went on his midnight ride. It was the purpose of warning the people that the British were marching to Lexington to arrest Sam Adams and John Hancock, then on a Concord and confiscate the weapons stored there by the Minutemen. By the time they got to Concord, they found the Minutemen waiting for them. Weapons in hand, they fired at the British, fought them, and beat them. From that battle came the American Revolution. There's an Arabic word to describe what these Minutemen did that day, and it's the word repeated many times in this courtroom. That word is jihad. And this is what my trial was about. All those videos and translations of my childish bickering over, oh, he translated this paragraph, and oh, he edited this sentence, and all these exhibits revolved around a single issue. Muslims who were defending themselves against the American soldiers doing to them exactly what the British did to the Americans. It was made crystal clear at trial that I never, ever plotted to kill Americans. At the shopping malls or wherever the story was. The government's own witnesses contradicted this claim. And we put expert after expert up on the stand who spent hours dissecting my every written word to explain my beliefs. Further, when I was free, the government sent an undercover agent to prod me into one of their little terror plots, but I refused to participate. Mysteriously, however, the jury never heard this. So this trial was not about my position on Muslims killing American civilians. It was about my position on Americans killing Muslim civilians, which is what Muslims should defend their lands from foreign invaders, whether they are Soviets, Americans, or Martians. This is what I believe, and what I've always believed, And what I will always believe, this is not terrorism and it is not extremism. It is the simple logic of self-defense. And what the arrows on the seal above your head represent, defense of the homeland. So I disagree with my lawyers when they say that you don't have to agree with my beliefs. No. Anyone with common sense and humanity has no choice but to agree with me. If someone breaks into your home to rob you and harm you or family, logic dictates that you do whatever it takes to expel the invaders from your home. But when that home is a Muslim land and the invader is the U.S. military, for some reason the standards suddenly change. Common sense is renamed terrorism. And the people defending themselves against those who came to kill them from across the ocean become the terrorists who are killing Americans. The mentality that America was victimized by when the British soldiers walked these streets 2.5 centuries ago is the same mentality Muslims are victimized with by American soldiers walking their streets today. And the mentality of colonialism, when Sergeant Bale shot those Afghans to death last month, I followed the discussion in the media just to see what people were saying, and what I noticed was that all the focus was on him. His life, his stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, the mortgage in his home, and he, as if he was the victim. I didn't see anyone talking about the people he actually killed, as if they were not real, they're not human. Unfortunately, this mentality trickles down to everyone in society, whether they realize it or not, even with my lawyers. It took nearly 2 years of discussing, explaining, and clarifying before they were finally able to think outside the box and at least ostensibly accept the logic in what I was saying. 2 years. If it took that long for people so intelligent, whose job is to defend me, to deprogram themselves, then to throw me in front of a random selected jury under the premise that they're my impartial peers. I mean, come on. I wasn't tried before a jury of my peers because with the mentality gripping America today, I have no peers. Counting on this fact, the government prosecuted me, not because they needed to, but simply because they could. I learned one more thing in history class. America has historically supported the most unjust policies against its minorities, practices that were even protected by law, only to look back and ask what we were thinking. Slavery, Jim Crow, the internment of Japanese during World War II, each was widely accepted by American society. Each was defended by the Supreme Court. But as time passed and America changed, both people and courts looked back and asked, what were we thinking? Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist by South African government and given a life sentence. But time passed, the world changed, and they realized how oppressive their policies were, that it was not he who was the terrorist, as they released him from prison. He even became president. So everything is subject, even this whole business of terrorism and who is a terrorist. It all depends on the time and place and who the superpower happens to be at the moment. In your eyes, I'm the terrorist. I'm the only one standing here in an orange jumpsuit. And it's perfectly reasonable that I be standing here in an orange jumpsuit. But history repeats itself. One day America will change and people will recognize this day for what it is. They will look at how hundreds of thousands of Muslims were killed and maimed by the U.S. military in foreign countries, yet somehow I'm going to prison for conspiring to kill and maim in those countries because I support the Mujahideen defending those people. They will look back on how the government spent millions of dollars to imprison me as a terrorist. Yet if we were to somehow bring Abir al-Janabi back to life, in the moment she was being gang raped by American soldiers, to put her on that witness stand and ask her who the terrorists were, she sure wouldn't be pointing at me. The government says that I was obsessed with violence, obsessed with killing Americans, but as Muslims living in these times, I can think of no lie more ironic. This is what he told the court as he was being sentenced to 25 years for simply writing against the policies of war. Simply standing up for the victims overseas, the civilians. Malcolm X wrote, "You're not supposed to be so blind with patriotism that you can't face reality. Wrong is wrong, no matter who does it or who says it." Truth is a foundational American principle and one of the most basic moral principles recognized by all people, regardless of their religious beliefs. Honesty is a virtue that any moral upright person will strive for. transparency and the pursuit of truth are guiding principles that are standard for any decent society. The opposite of truth is dishonesty, lies, deception, hypocrisy. The truth is the basis of rational policy and the moral decision making. People cannot make proper decisions if the correct information is hidden and not allowed to influence the dialogue. Prevention of discussion is the primary means of keeping truth from being discovered. The concealing of the truth is the means of exploitation, and it is used to divide people, foster animosity between people, and to create justification for treating some people as inferior to others. The 9/11 attacks have exposed the need for truth, honesty, and openness in our nation's dialogue and policy. The war in Iraq has shown how easily a nation can be led into war based on propaganda and false evidence. The government's response to 9/11 have killed over twice as many Americans, soldiers, or civilians even, than the World Trade Center did. The government's response to 9/11 has killed over millions of civilians more than the alleged terrorists did on 9/11 as well. To put it simply, I believe half measures will avail us nothing. If we want to arrest the sickness of greed and money, hunger, that threatens to self-destruct our society and human race, and ravage the planet, we have to go all the way. No more business as usual. This is critical mass, people. DEFCON 10. We must not be too quick to compromise. We, the people, are in control, not the 1%, the elite, the few. We've seen a vast number of changes in our society over our lifetimes. All of our important values, like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, have been destroyed. We've seen the rise of corruption in our leaders from on a national level to the local level. We've seen all the wealth we have built up and accumulated stolen. How can we stop this? Is there anything that we can do? First things first, educate yourselves and others. Educate yourselves about what they are doing and why they are doing it. Read and understand your civil and constitutional rights. Demand these rights from the city hall of your city to the front steps of the White House. And then help to make change by being active and voicing your disapproval to the injustices being done to Muslims. Let it be known to those mindless puppets controlled by the 1% by voting every last one of those bums out of office, from the White House to the House. As one of our founding fathers put it, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. Thomas Jefferson. Thank you very much, Pete.
And now I'll close the show with the information about the provocative movie we'll be showing on Monday, February 24th. It's called Waiting for Mercy by Ellie Bernstein. And it's about the FBI entrapment of two Muslim men in Albany, New York. After the film, Stephen Downs, one of the attorneys for these two entrapped men, will lead the Q&A. The film will be shown in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford at 7 p.m. Books and other materials will be available at the event. Please join us and park in Lot B. February marks the sixth anniversary of 9/11 Wake-Up Call. The first show aired on February 12, 2008. And I want to take a moment to thank all of the listeners who have tuned in over the past 6 years. You're the best. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.